Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is December 5th. And looking at the schedule right here, let's see, fall 2011. Indeed, that's our semester. Let's just look and see when the final exam is going to be. Looks like it's a week from today. So it's a week from today, right at 10:30 in this classroom. So bring a Scantron and your picture ID. As a matter of fact, if you don't have your picture ID, don't even show up to class, okay? So please bring your picture ID because it's going to be really hard to find everybody running around that last week during finals, and a good eraser. All right, so lab practicums are this week. So I got one more today, a couple more on Wednesday, and we got a couple lectures to finish up the diversification system. What's another name for diversification system? The reproductive system. Yeah, what's the function of the reproductive system? Is to produce diversity in the population, right? So we don't all croak at the same thing. Except for two cases. What are two pathologies that will affect everybody in here? Women, the first one, women more than men, because men typically have stronger bones to begin with. Osteoporosis, right? So even though we reproduce sexually, osteoporosis is still a problem. How do you protect yourself from osteoporosis? Oh, you can't, huh? No, you can. Who wants to have, raise your hand if you want to have broken bones as you get older. Nobody's raising their hand. Well, then, how do you protect yourself from osteoporosis? Two things, but there's some subcategories to these things. What are the two main categories of how you protect yourself? Exercise is number one. Okay, what's number two? Diet. Okay, but what do you have to have in your diet? Two things. Calcium and what else? And vitamin D. That's right, vitamin D, and you can protect yourself. What's the second disease process? And this only affects men, not women. And that is prostate disease. And raise your hand if you want to have prostate disease. No? Prostate disease? How do you protect yourself from prostate disease? Diet and exercise. Same thing, right? Exercise the prostate gland. And what kind of diet? Low-fat diet. Low-fat diet. Okay, can protect you from prostate disease. And maybe some other things, behavioral things too. All right, diversification system. Let's just look at a typical cell. Here we have a typical cell right here. And there's genetic material in two locations in the cell. Where do you have genetic material? The nucleus. Let's draw that in here. So here's the nucleus. How many chromosomes are inside this nucleus? Okay, there are 46. All together, but they're arranged in a special set. What are the two sets? There's two sets of chromosomes. All right, there's a number 1, a number 2, number 3, all the way down to number 23. And the same in this second set over here, 1, 2, 3, all the way down to 23. And so if we add up all the chromosomes, you get 46. Okay, so why are there two sets? What's the simple reason why you have two sets of chromosomes? Because you have a mom and a dad, right? Even though you don't have a mom and a dad right now, at some point in time, you had a mom and a dad. Even if you're a test tube baby, you had a mom and a dad somewhere way back when. And you get half of these chromosomes from your mom. We call those the maternal set, right? And then you get the second set from your dad, and we label those P. Those are the papa chromosomes. But what's the real name? Maternal and paternal chromosomes, right? So that's where these chromosomes come from. All right, so this is inside the nucleus. That genetic material determines how your body is put together. It's the blueprint for who you are. And so that determines the structure. But along with determining structure, what else does it determine? If the structure is defined by these chromosomes, what else is defined? The physiology, right? So the physiology of the cell, or how it functions, is also defined by those chromosomes. All right, so that's the first place. Where's the second place that has genetic material? Okay, anybody know? Anybody know? I heard one right answer that I like, and that is, yeah, these little bean-shaped structures right here, right, these little mitochondria, have their own genetic material, and it's just a chromosome. It's not inside of a nucleus. As a matter of fact, that mitochondria just kind of looks like a bacteria, and remember, that's the endosymbiont theory of mitochondria, that a cell that was similar to a human cell way back when was infected by this bacteria, but they got along so well that the bacteria decided to live inside the cell because it's protected, gets nutrients. And the job of mitochondria, once again, is to produce energy for this cell, right, in terms of ATP. So it's a nice symbiotic relationship. Under most circumstances, it works really, really nice. So there's genetic material, don't forget, inside this mitochondria. And there's one chromosome, as far as I know, maybe as far as anybody knows. Okay, so this right here is what we just call a somatic cell. This is just a typical kind of cell that you have in your body all over the place. It has 46 chromosomes. All right, but these cells in your body don't live forever. Like, for instance, red blood cells, how long do they live for? Only about 120 days. All right, and then they die, and what does your body have to do? It's got to replace those cells that die, otherwise what will happen to you? Well, you would die, okay, but it becomes a disease, right, and you all know the name of that disease before you die. That's called anemia, right? So about 2 million cells in your body die every second, so you got to replace those cells. What's the name of that process that those cells are replaced with? What's that process called? Okay, you're thinking. I'll give you a hint, but it's not a really good hint. It starts with an M. Mitosis. Yeah, mitosis. All right, so here's just a normal cell inside your body. All right, and the process of mitosis, what does it produce? So in terms of mitosis, this is what we call a parent cell. And a parent cell is going to do what? It's going to replicate itself into these two cells right here and right here. These are what we call daughter cells. And what can you tell me about these daughter cells? What are they like compared to this parent cell? They're identical to the parent cell. So, if they're identical, how many mitochondria are over here? Okay, let's just say there's one. And here's another mitochondria over here and over here. Well, if we started with one mitochondria and we end up with two over here, what had to happen to this mitochondria? It has to replicate itself, right? So, and indeed, that happens during the growth phase of the cell cycle, where organelles are replicated. All right, so eventually you're going to have at least two mitochondria over here with a chromosome, so that you end up with one over here and one over here. All right, and what about this? What about these chromosomes? If you have 46 and then we split them up into these two daughter cells, what has to happen to the chromosomes so that we have 46 over here and 46 over here? What has to happen to those chromosomes? They have to replicate themselves as well, just like the mitochondria before the cells split. All right, so typically a chromosome is going to look like this. Here's a single chromosome, right? So that's what we find in the parent cell. But before mitosis takes place, this has to be replicated. We looked at DNA replication. So here is a replicated chromosome. But when it forms this X right here, you got to realize that there are what? Two identical chromosomes that are joined together. People call it a chromosome, but there are actually two. Right? So that during this process of mitosis, right, you end up with 46 of these individual chromosomes over here. And chromosomes replicate during what? Interphase? During the growth phase of the cell cycle? All right, and do you remember the phases of mitosis? Yeah, it's what? Yeah, it's interphase, then prophase, then metaphase, anaphase, telophase. And during metaphase, all of these things line up right on the equator of the cell, and these two sister chromatids separate into these two daughter cells, and then these are what we call daughter chromosomes over here as well. All right, so can you remember that about mitosis? All right, so we got 46 and 46. The way we talk about the number of chromosomes, if we have two copies of chromosomes inside the nucleus, we call that diploid, dip for having two copies. Right, di is another word for two. So sometimes we call this diploid. And in an abbreviated form, sometimes we just call that a 2N. 2N because you have, what, two sets of chromosomes, one from your mom, one from your dad. So that's how your body can replace old and damaged cells. But what's another reason for mitosis that produces identical cells? These are like clones of each other. One more reason for mitosis. Yeah, for growth. Yeah, for growth. And somebody said gestation. I kind of like that because during gestation, what's happening to you? You start out with just, you're just a single cell at some point in time, and then you, that's not a very interesting form of life. I mean, it's still human life, but it's not really interesting because why? Can't come to class, take notes. Can't take practicums if you're just a single cell, right? So mitosis is important for growth and development as well as replacing old and damaged cells. All right, so that is mitosis. This is what we call asexual reproduction, because what are these daughter cells like compared to the parent cell? They're exactly the same, right? So that's asexual reproduction, unlike how we come into existence. So I know you're all interested, well, how did we come about? We don't come about as through a process called mitosis. We come about through a process of meiosis. All right, meiosis. And meiosis just has two rounds of mitosis. Okay, so meiosis, why is meiosis important? Because we have, in this particular case, we got something that your book calls a stem cell. Maybe a better word is a germ cell. All right, that has 46 chromosomes inside the nucleus. All right, and it's going to undergo a process of meiosis. But instead of producing two daughter cells, what we're going to get are four different gametes. And a gamete just has 23 chromosomes inside the nucleus. So we got one here, and one here. So these are what we call gametes. And gametes are sex cells. They have half the number of chromosomes. And so there's one set, but it's still a set that goes from 1, 2, 3, all the way down to number 23 right here. And the number 1 chromosome is the biggest, and then number 2 is a little bit smaller. Number 3 is still smaller, so it goes down all the way to number 22, which is the smallest chromosome. So these are large, these are small, number 23 is small, number 1 is really large. So even underneath a microscope, people can tell what chromosome or the number of a chromosome that they're looking at based on its size, maybe a little bit by its shape. Okay, number 23 is kind of special, and there's two kinds of chromosomes that can be a number 23. There can be a large chromosome, and we're going to call that an X, or there can be a small chromosome, and we're going to call that a Y. The Y is almost identical to the X, except it's missing a piece over here. So let me circle this little piece. So the blue is going to represent the part of the chromosome that is missing. So here's a part of the chromosome that is missing. It just lost. It just broke off. Right? With these, we call sex chromosomes. The rest of these, 1 through 22, are what we call homologous chromosomes. Homologous chromosomes because the number 1 that you get from what your one parent is going to be almost exactly the same as the number 1 that you get from your other parent. They're going to have the same size and shape. So the number 2 that you got from your mom is going to be the exact same size as the number two that you got from your dad. But they're going to carry different information so that a new individual is a mixture of both your mom and your dad. The sex chromosomes are different, so we call, since they have a different shape, we call those non-homologous or sex chromosomes. Okay, and I think that's what I would like for you to know about meiosis for right now. Okay, so there are two kinds of gametes. You have sperm. That's one kind of gamete. And here is an oocyte, or an egg. That's a female gamete. And what's the number of chromosomes inside of a sperm? Yeah, 23. Okay, same for an egg. 23 here, 23 right here. And then when a sperm joins with an egg, what kind of cell are you left with? It forms a single cell with how many chromosomes? They both contribute 23. All right, so here is one set of 23. This is, in this particular case, the paternal set. Here's another. That's the maternal set right there. So we're back to 46 chromosomes, which is what a normal human should have. All right, so this is a 2N cell. What's another name for a 2N cell? Okay, we say diploid over here. But these over here, these are 1N cells. Gametes are 1N. And another name for a 1N cell is a haploid cell. Okay, and they're haploid so that with this process right here that produces the cell right here, you end up back with 46 chromosomes. So what do you call this process where these two gametes join together? Yeah, that's fertilization. Everybody knew that before taking this class. But now, what's the name of this single cell product of fertilization? What is this called? What is this cell called? This thing right here is called a, and we're all one of these, zygote. All right, so the single cell product of fertilization is called a zygote. And what's the ploidy? Here's a good word that you should know. What's the ploidy of a gamete? I mean, of a zygote. What's the ploidy of a zygote? The ploidy is, you could say 2N, or you could say diploid. Okay, that's the ploidy. What's the ploidy of a gamete? It's haploid or 1N. All right, so that's how you use that terminology. All right, so what organ produces this gamete right here? What organ produces a sperm? Yeah, the testes, and that's only in males. All right, so that's what I was leading up to on the picture that we see on the screen. Let me turn some of these lights down. No, that light I like, that light I don't, that light I don't. And this one, I can turn that one off. All right, so here is the testes, and we kind of looked at this already. The tubes that produce sperm are the seminiferous tubules right within the testes, and you can see there are many different lobes in the testes. All right, so let's go and take a look at some of these tubes once again in a different view. All right, so let's make a cross-section of a seminiferous tubule or a cross-section through one of these lobes right here and take a micrograph of it. So here's a seminiferous tubule, and you can see some developing spermatocytes, and the flagella is growing out into the lumen of the tube. And then here are some cells that are outside the seminiferous tubule. These are what we call interstitial cells. Sometimes they're called cells of Leydig, L-E-Y-D-I-G. These cells produce testosterone, which is a hormone, male hormone, that promotes spermatogenesis. It promotes the health of the germ cells that line this tube, as well as some cells that help nourish sperm as they're developing. And those are called Sertoli cells. Sertoli cells just nourish sperm as they're growing. All right, so let's take a look at this process. So here is one part of the seminiferous tubule, so we're zoomed way, way in. Can't even show a whole seminiferous tubule on this particular slide. right? And I don't see any Sertoli cells on this particular slide right here, but don't forget there's Sertoli cells as well. So here is a spermatogonium. This is a germ cell or a stem cell. And what's the ploidy of this spermatogonium right here? What's the ploidy? Another way of asking, how many sets of chromosomes are inside this cell? Yeah, there's two sets, right? There's a maternal set and a paternal set. And then it's going to undergo mitosis to produce a type A daughter cell, which is identical to the spermatogonium right here. And then also, it produces a type B daughter cell. And the type B daughter cell then is going to form gametes. What's the name of the process where you go from a parent cell to gametes right here? We go from a diploid cell to four haploid cells. What's that process called? That is meiosis. All right, so you're going from a diploid cell to haploid cells over here. So there's a reduction in the number of chromosomes in this particular process, and hence that's what the name means. Meiosis means a reduction, literally, and it's a reduction not only in cytoplasm that we see over here, which is kind of a minor point, but the major point, it's a reduction in the number of chromosomes. All right, so how would you talk about the ploidy of these gametes right here, and in particular the sperm? That's a particular kind of gamete. What's the ploidy of a sperm? Yeah, it's one half, right? Or it's haploid. So that's why last time I was talking about these are as being like half human cells, because they have the half number of chromosomes. Okay, so the process for meiosis is that there are two rounds of cell division. All right, so this type B daughter cell turns into a primary spermatocyte, and then something's going to split. So there's meiosis one and meiosis two. So let's take a look and see what meiosis one and meiosis two. Right after meiosis two, then we have some early spermatids right here that don't have a flagellum. Right, so these actually kind of look like cells. They have cytoplasm and mitochondria and a nucleus and everything. All right, and when we get to these early spermatids, then there's a second process that takes over, and that is spermatogenesis. So early spermatids then actually mature to become a sperm cell. This all happens within the seminiferous tubule. So let's look at the difference between meiosis one and meiosis two. So these are similar to some pictures that you have in your book. All right, so here we have just a regular germ cell, and it has the ploidy is, it's a diploid cell, and all of the chromosomes are being used, so the chromatin is extended. You can't really see what's happening inside the nucleus. Well, I see a little nucleolus right here. And then what can you tell me about prophase? What happens during prophase? Just use your knowledge of mitosis from way back when. What happens to chromatin during, what's the first phase of mitosis? Yes, prophase. What happens during prophase? The chromatin condenses, right, and the nuclear envelope disappears. And that's exactly what we see right here. All right, so the nuclear envelope disappears, and instead of having extended chromatin, we have condensed chromatin, and the chromatin condenses into these chromosomes. Now here I see two copies of a chromosome forming an X. We see that, which looks like red to me. All right, and then here is the second one. So you can consider the red chromosome like the paternal chromosome and the blue one the maternal chromosome. All right, so this is indeed a diploid cell. And so here we have one out of the 23 chromosomes, and here is another of the 23 chromosomes pairing up right here. And then they line up right on the equator of the cell. What's the phase where chromosomes line up right on the equator of the cell? Yeah, it's metaphase. So here we see it right here. All right, so both the maternal and paternal chromosomes line up together right on the equator of the cell, and then things start to separate. Where do things start to separate? What phase? Anaphase. And this is the first round of meiosis, so we call this anaphase one. All right, so the chromosomes don't split apart. They still stay paired together, but there's just a random pairing of maternal chromosomes, and maternal chromosomes get pulled to the top of the cell, and then the same thing down to the bottom of the cell, down over here. So we call this, okay, meiosis one, where the homologous chromosomes separate. So what are the homologous chromosomes? Okay, so it is where the maternal set separates from the paternal set, but it's just a, if number one chromosome, say, moves to the top from the paternal set, then where does the maternal set go? Down to the bottom. But the next chromosome, number two, it just might be just a flip of the coin. Maybe it's the maternal set that goes to the top. And then what goes down to the bottom? The paternal set. All right, so there, with meiosis one right here, all right, it's just a flipping of a coin as to which set goes to the top and which goes to the bottom. Right? Sometimes the maternal set does, sometimes the paternal set. So what gets set up then is that the gametes are all going to be different because it's always a flip of a coin, who goes to the top and who goes down to the bottom, right over here. All right, so this is what we call meiosis one. All right, so homologous chromosomes separate during meiosis one. And then a second round of mitosis has to take place. And we call that meiosis two. All right, so just like in mitosis, you have a cleavage furrow. We call it, and the cells separate. So what do we call that? When the cells, cytoplasm separates, and you have the development of this cleavage furrow, and finally it pinches apart into two daughter cells. What do we call that phase of mitosis? That's called telophase, right? So this is right at the end of meiosis one, which was this slide right here, right? So after anaphase, okay, then you have telophase, you get this cleavage furrow. These chromosomes that are still attached to each other are what we call sister chromatids. So this chromosome and this chromosome are what we call homologous chromosomes, but when they're attached together at the centromere right here, these two, remember there's really two chromosomes right here, we call those sister chromatids. So that leads us into meiosis two. So here is like the parent cell, and now these cells right here only have one copy of every chromosome. So these are, let's see if that is shown right here. All right, so meiosis one produces these haploid cells, but now these have to separate, right? The chromosomes, the sister chromatids have to separate, and that's what we call meiosis two, to give us four independent cells. Let me bring this back over. All right, so during meiosis two, all right, let me ask you a question. How many, like in this little area right here, how many chromosomes do we have in this area right here? There's one chromosome, but it's been replicated, right? So there are actually two chromosomes attached to each other, but these are pretty much identical to each other. These are what we call sister chromatids. So that's what we end up over here. So then we start another round of separation. So these chromosomes, right, end up on the equator of the cell. That's what we call metaphase, right? But now we're in the second round of meiosis. We call that meiosis two. The same for this other cell down over here. And then in anaphase, guess what separates? I see something separating right here. Not the homologous chromosomes, but the sister chromatids separate. They end up in two separate cells, as well as this one down over here. The sister chromatids separate, right? So now you have four haploid daughter cells forming. One, two, three, four. All right, so every stem cell in this particular case is going to produce four different sperm with different combinations of maternal and paternal chromosomes in it. So that's what we have right here. All right, so these are the early spermatids. What's the ploidy of these spermatids right here? Yeah, so they're haploid, right? They're just one end. They're haploid. And then they start to develop into a functioning sperm. And a functioning sperm has a flagellum. So the centrioles move down to bottom pole of the cell, right? And from those centrioles, remember, they organize microtubules, right? So then they organize the flagellum, starts to grow out away from the centrioles. Mitochondria move into this part, which we call the midpiece of the sperm, and the cytoplasm starts to go away, right? This extra cytoplasm goes away, and the nuclear material stays in the sperm head right here. And then eventually, these break apart and form four independent sperm cells. So this process is what we call spermatogenesis, and meiosis is the two rounds of, you could think of it as like being mitosis, two rounds of mitosis producing these haploid cells. So here's another view of a seminiferous tubule, another illustration. Here are the stem or germ cells. Here is a Sertoli cell. The job of a Sertoli cell is to nourish these cells as they're maturing. And so here is a spermatogonium. Here's a type A. Here's the type B daughter cell. So this is just a regular kind of mitosis that produces a primary spermatocyte. And this is a diploid cell. And then the primary spermatocyte is going to go through two rounds of mitosis. Right, so it's a double nuclear reduction. That process is what we call meiosis. So first the homologous chromosomes separate, and then the homologous chromosomes separate then the sister chromatids separate to form these four gametes right here. All right, so the first round produces a secondary spermatocyte, and then spermatids are formed when the sister chromatids separate. And then, as you can see, these cells are migrating from a superficial region of the tube toward the lumen of the seminiferous tubule. And as it migrates down, then the flagellum develops, extra cytoplasm is shed off, and the mitochondria end up in this midpiece of the sperm cell. And then they break away and become free swimming sperm in the lumen of a seminiferous tubule. So this process right here is what we call spermatogenesis. Okay? Spermatogenesis. So we can take a look at how that happens. So you can see the germ cell right here, and I can see some mitochondria. And the mitochondria flow with cytoplasm down around the midpiece of a sperm. So here's the midpiece, here's the tailpiece, here's the sperm head. So mitochondria end up in the midpiece of a sperm right here. That's going to be important in a little bit. Then here is the headpiece. The headpiece contains the nucleus. What's inside this nucleus right here? Yeah, DNA, basically 23 chromosomes. And don't forget, there's DNA right here in mitochondria as well, right? Mitochondria have DNA, but where do we find the mitochondria DNA? Is it in the head, the midpiece, or the tailpiece of a sperm? The mitochondria DNA. It's in the midpiece only. It's not in the head of a sperm. It's just within the midpiece of a sperm. All right, so this thing then with ejaculation can swim right up the vagina through the cervical canal and up into the uterus, then out the fallopian tubes or through a fallopian tube, and if it's meant to be, then fertilization takes place in a fallopian tube. Right? If fertilization takes place in a pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity, what's that called? An implantation takes place. Then that is called an ectopic pregnancy. All right, and what kind of process is, what does that always lead to? Well, then that's a fatal process, right? For the mother as well as for the developing embryo. Okay, so that is meiosis in the male, and here is a nice micrograph of some sperm, and you can see the headpiece right here, the midpiece, and the tailpiece. The part of the headpiece, this tip right here, is called an acrosome, And the acrosome contains enzymes that will be able to digest certain parts of an egg cell to allow for fertilization. So don't forget about this acrosome right here. Okay, so that's all I think I'm going to say about the male reproductive system. All right, let's talk about the female reproductive system. It's going to be sort of similar. Oh, one last thing for male reproductive system. The production of sperm, right, after puberty lasts the whole lifetime of the individual. All right, so as a male gets older, the sperm count certainly decreases, but they're able to produce viable sperm throughout their whole lifespan. Okay. Female reproductive system, a little bit more complicated. Let's look at, what's the organ that produces the female gamete? It's the ovary. Okay, so here's an ovary, so that's the analogous structure in the female. And so here is the ovary, and then we have blood vessels. Here's an ovarian artery and vein entering an ovary. Here's the ovarian ligament, and notice that the ovary is not directly attached to the fallopian tube. It's just approximate to the fallopian tube. And the fimbriated edge kind of fits over or caps one end of the ovary, and but it's not completely surrounded by a fallopian tube. So here is an oocyte that gets ovulated from an ovary, and what is it missing compared to a male gamete? That doesn't have a flagellum, right? So it's not a motile cell, can't swim around, right? And this egg moves into the fallopian tube and then down the fallopian tube toward the uterus, right? And how does that happen? I think I mentioned one of the processes that allows that to happen, even though this oocyte right here is not freely motile like a sperm cell. But how does this egg end up in the fallopian tube right here? Yeah, because the epithelium or the endothelium of this tube right here is ciliated, and it's sweeping and it sets up a flow down in the direction toward the uterus. But the fallopian tube also has some smooth muscle, not nearly as much as the uterus, but some smooth muscle, and it contracts in a rhythmic fashion, just like, and we call that peristalsis, right? When something is moved from one end of a tube in one direction down to the other end of the tube. Right, so by this motion of the cilia and by peristalsis, the egg certainly can find its way as long as the fallopian tube is functioning into the uterus right here. All right, so let's look at some of these structures inside the ovary. We have a number of primordial follicles, and these follicles develop before the individual is born. So the number of possible gametes that can be formed is a fetal process. And I think before you're born, I think there are about 3 million primordial follicles that develop, right? And then by the time you're born, maybe about 500,000 of them die and regress and then resorb by the individual. And then by the time the individual reaches puberty, there are about 300,000 primordial follicles left that can actually develop into an oocyte. So that's the total reproductive potential of a female is about 300,000 individuals. And some people might say, well, that seems kind of unfair because a male can produce millions almost every day, but a female can only produce about 300,000 in their entire reproductive life. Okay? But that's probably not such a big deal because I have never known anyone to want more than 300,000 children anyway, right? So that's perfectly fine. Okay, but these do degenerate, the proportion do degenerate every single year. Okay, and then once a month, a primordial follicle, or a set of them, maybe 12, will develop into a bigger structure that we call a secondary follicle. And some of those are lost. And then usually about one per ovary develops into a mature follicle over here. So here is a mature follicle with an antrum or a fluid-filled space on the inside. Here is an oocyte. And right at mid-cycle, the oocyte is expelled from the ovary and is ready to be fertilized at that point in time. Now, the remaining follicle doesn't degenerate completely, but there are still many living cells. After a follicle ovulates an egg, it becomes a corpus luteum. And you can see what's the size of this second corpus luteum that we see inside the ovary. Does it look like it's regressing, getting smaller, disappearing, or what? It's actually looking bigger, right, than this developing corpus luteum over here. So this is an important endocrine structure, just like a follicle right here is an important endocrine structure. In the male produces testosterone as a sex steroid, and females in the ovary produces two kinds of sex steroids. There's estrogen and progesterone, and we're going to look at the cycling, the ovarian cycle and uterine cycle in the female. It's going to be controlled by progesterone and estrogen. Before ovulation, the follicle, the developing follicle, will synthesize and secrete primarily estrogen. Okay, and then after ovulation, something drastic changes. As you can see, the oocyte leaves, all right, and the follicle becomes a corpus luteum. The corpus luteum then changes what it's secreting. It kind of scales back how much estrogen that it is producing and starts to synthesize and release progesterone. So during the follicular phase of the ovarian cycle, it's ruled pretty much by estrogen. But after ovulation, the ovary then starts to secrete progesterone. All right, so the male doesn't have to worry about such things, all right, but female does. So because the uterus has to be controlled by the events that are happening inside the ovary right here. All right, so let's take a look at... Okay, this slide right here. This is a pretty good synopsis of what we've talked about so far. Right, you have primordial follicles that a female is born with, and then after puberty, during the monthly cycle, a number of them will develop into primary follicles, maybe about 12 of them, and then a handful will die during maturation. Maybe one will reach a secondary follicular phase right here, and then move on to become a mature follicle. Sometimes we call this a antral follicle because it has this space inside of it that's filled with fluid. And sometimes it's also called a graafian follicle. So a mature follicle or an antral follicle or graafian follicle is ready to expel this oocyte during ovulation. All right, so then what happens to this follicle after ovulation? Does it just completely disappear? It becomes an important organ that we call the corpus luteum, or a little yellow body right here. All right, and then if fertilization does not take place, the corpus luteum does regress. It starts to go away, turns into this white structure right here. And let me go back a couple slides. I guess I want to go back to this one. Okay. So if fertilization does not take place and implantation does not take place, then this corpus luteum regresses, right? And then another cycle can start. And the regressed corpus luteum is what we call the corpus albicans. It's just a little white little cyst right here that gets that degenerates and then is resorbed by the body. All right. So let's look at the coordination of the uterus and the ovary. Okay, so here, let's look at a couple of graphs. Here we have a plot of some levels of hormones, so hormone levels in the blood versus time, and the time is days, and this shows the whole cycle, and a typical textbook cycle is 28 days long. So what day is right smack in the middle of the cycle? Okay. Yeah, it's day number 14 right here. Day number 14. And this cycle right here shows hormones from the anterior pituitary gland. And the two hormones are the gonadotropins, luteinizing hormone, and follicle-stimulating hormone. And you can see right at mid-cycle, there's a big peak in these two particular hormones. All right, so day one through day five is what we call the menstrual phase of the uterine cycle. And that's just a period where the endometrium of the uterus is sloughed off and expelled from the body in a mild hemorrhage. Okay, and then we have the proliferative phase, right? And the proliferative phase, we have a kind of a high level of follicle-stimulating hormone, all right? And what's inside of a follicle? We looked at that a little bit earlier. What's inside of a follicle? Okay. You have an oocyte, right? A developing oocyte. And so follicle-stimulating hormone causes a follicle to develop. Let's maybe go to this slide right here. All right, so here is a follicle that's developing. All right, that's during the proliferative phase. All right, proliferative phase, and proliferation means that these cells are replicating themselves by mitosis. So a follicle is growing in size by mitosis. All right, that's a proliferative phase. All right, and then right at day 14, you have that big surge in luteinizing hormone. This big surge in luteinizing hormone causes ovulation, right? And so here you have the follicle developing, and then what happens after ovulation? What happens to the follicle? It becomes the corpus luteum, okay? And then you have big decreases in LH and FSH, and then that takes us to the secretory phase. Right, so the secretory phase is when the endometrium then, since it's developed, starts to secrete compounds that will aid in implantation. All right, so this just shows fluctuations in what we call gonadotropins from the anterior pituitary, luteinizing hormone and follicle-stimulating hormone. What you should remember is that LH causes ovulation. Follicle-stimulating hormone causes development of a follicle. Okay, development of a follicle. So those are two bullet points for what LH does and what FSH does. FSH causes development of a follicle, and LH causes ovulation. Okay, so what we have right here is the ovarian cycle. All right, so what organ should you think about when you're contemplating the ovarian cycle? The ovary. Yeah, and what's inside an ovary? You have follicles, maybe at different stages of development, right? And then after ovulation, you have the corpus luteum. And if implantation doesn't take place, then you have the development of the degenerating corpus luteum or the corpus albicans. Okay, so in terms of the ovarian cycle, all right, we got three phases. Right, the first phase right here is what we call the follicular phase, and we see development of a follicle during this point in time, during follicular phase. What hormone is causing this follicle to mature? Yeah, FSH from the anterior pituitary gland. All right, and then what hormone causes ovulation right here on day 14? That is LH, and where does LH come from once again? Same place that FSH comes from, which is the anterior pituitary gland. All right, and then after ovulation, what happens to the leftover follicular cells? Do they just regress immediately and go away because they're not important? Okay, and that's not true because the leftover follicle then develops into the corpus luteum. Okay. These cells of the follicle, as the follicle is growing, produce and release estrogen. All right, so during the follicular phase, there's going to be high levels of estrogen. And then after ovulation, estrogen decreases and another hormone takes over, and that is progesterone. Okay. All right, so this is the ovarian cycle, and then superimposed with the same time scale is the uterine cycle down over here, at least some definitions of different parts of the uterine cycle. So follicular phase, luteal phase, and ovulation pertain to the ovarian cycle, but menstrual phase, proliferative phase, and secretory phase pertain to the uterine cycle. So we're actually looking at two different cycles, the ovarian cycle on the top and the uterine cycle down here at the bottom. Let's take a look at the next slide. So we have two more hormones to look at right here. Plasma levels of hormones. All right, we have estrogen and progesterone. Where are these coming from? Where are these coming from? Okay, estrogen's coming from a developing follicle. All right, so the developing follicle is synthesizing and releasing estrogens. All right, but not very much progesterone. But then right at mid-cycle, something kind of amazing happens. What happens? The release of an oocyte. Right, and then the follicle disappears and it becomes the corpus luteum. The corpus luteum stops its massive secretion of estrogen and starts to secrete progesterone. All right, so the uterine cycle, the first part is called the menstrual phase, the second part is the proliferative phase, and then the third part is called the secretory phase. All right, so the secretory phase is ruled by progesterone. The proliferative phase is ruled by estrogen from follicles. All right, let's take a look at the endometrium. So here is just a diagram of what the endometrium looks like. And what layer of the uterus is the endometrium? That's the inner layer. It's the deepest layer, right? So that's a layer for implantation. So here we see the different phases of the uterine cycle, and we're looking at the uterus. All right, so the menstrual phase is when the endometrium disappears, so we can see regression of the endometrium, and the cells are, right, if all is well, leave the body. But remember, some of these endometrial cells can go retrograde up a fallopian tube and enter the pelvic cavity, and sometimes they don't die there. They actually live for a number of years. And what does that cause? Endometriosis, right, that causes an inflammation or an irritation of the pelvic cavity and the organs in the pelvic cavity, all right, but they should actually be lost from the body, all right, but right at this time, right, the follicles are developing, and then they start to secrete estrogen. So what happens to the endometrium? Estrogen signals the endometrium to grow. And that's what we mean by proliferation. Proliferation is just basically a mitosis process where you end up, we start with one cell and then you have two and then four and then 16. So the endometrium grows. Something else that happens is that the endometrium, the vascular supply of the endometrium also grows. We call that angiogenesis because implantation, right, if there is an embryo, will need oxygen and nutrients. So this functional layer of the endometrium, right, develops a lot of blood vessels. And then, right at ovulation, then the secretory phase begins. And the secretory phase of the endometrium is controlled by progesterone. So there's the endometrium grows just a little bit more, but now it really matures to where there are glands that start to secrete substances, and we're not really sure what all these substances are, but they aid in implantation. Since these glands are secreting into the uterus, we call that the secretory phase of the uterine cycle. So here we see the uterine cycle, and it's controlled by hormones from the ovary. What are the two hormones that from the ovary that control how the endometrium grows when it's lost, right, and when these glands develop? What are the hormones called? Estrogen and progesterone. So estrogen first during the proliferative phase and progesterone second during the secretory phase. All right. The job of progesterone is to make sure that the endometrium is mature and is ready for implantation. All right. And there's something else. Say if fertilization did take place, maybe around day 20 or so, or day 19 or day 18, and implantation takes place, what hormone is necessary to maintain the endometrium right here? Take a guess. Is it one that's causing proliferation, or is it one that's maintaining the endometrium in a mature state? It's the latter. So it's progesterone. Right? So progesterone is necessary to maintain the endometrium during gestation, and hence the name. Progesterone is just a short form of a hormone that we call progestational hormone. What's gestation? That's the period of development, embryonic development. So progestational hormone and progesterone really are the same hormones. And high levels of progesterone are necessary to maintain the endometrium. And in order to have gestation, what kind of endometrium do you have to have? A nice mature endometrium. So if progesterone were to decrease, like we see right here, progesterone is decreasing, what's going to happen to the endometrium? It's going to regress, right? It's going to degenerate, and then the person will lose it from their body. All right, but if implantation does take place right here, then progesterone has to be held at a fairly high level in order to maintain a pregnancy. All right, and you know the name of the organ that secretes progesterone. What's the name of the organ that secretes progesterone and maintains the endometrium right here? What is that? What is that organ that does that? How many slides do I have to go back? Not too many. I see the answer right here on this slide. What's the organ that maintains pregnancy or maintains the endometrium because it's secreting progesterone? It is the corpus luteum. Here's my cursor. Here's the corpus luteum. Okay? So if the corpus luteum regresses, then a new cycle is going to start, right? But if implantation does take place, then the corpus luteum does not regress. All right, so let's go back to this particular slide right here. So if implantation takes place right here, there is now a signal that's sent, right, from this region back to the ovary that causes the corpus luteum, right, to just maintain itself. Where is it at? All right, so if implantation does not take place, the corpus luteum regresses. That signals a new round of the ovarian and uterine cycle. But if implantation does take place, the corpus luteum is receiving a signal from the placenta or developing placenta, right? And it actually grows. And as it's growing, what is the corpus luteum secreting? Progesterone, maintaining the endometrium for gestation. All right, so that signaling hormone that comes from the placenta, right? So I don't have an actual picture of a placenta, but let's pretend that implantation does take place and the placenta is starting to grow. The placenta secretes a hormone that goes back to the ovary that tells the corpus luteum to stay healthy and secrete progesterone because there is a pregnancy. And does anybody know the name of that hormone? Some of you have probably measured it with little kits you can buy in the store. Yeah, it's called human chorionic gonadotropin. So HCG is secreted by the placenta. It goes back to the ovary, and it tells the corpus luteum not to regress. And so the corpus luteum secretes progesterone. So instead of the endometrium disappearing right here, it maintains itself, and it maintains pregnancy as a result of that. All right, so that's called human chorionic gonadotropin, or HCG, and that's the thing that you can measure, right, when you have a pregnancy test. Human chorionic gonadotropin is a sign that somebody is pregnant, right, that the placenta is viable and healthy, and that the endometrium is viable and healthy as well. Okay, I want to say one last thing about that human chorionic gonadotropin, because we did talk about some scary things. One of the scary things was, okay, so here's that ovary, right? So for instance, if there's an ectopic pregnancy, right? So if implantation takes place in the fallopian tube or in mesentery or something like that, right, the developing embryo with placenta, right, the placenta is going to tell the corpus luteum to keep secreting progesterone because human chorionic gonadotropin is coming from the placenta, right? So that embryo is going to develop. But as it's developing, the blood supply can't keep up with its growth. And so the placenta starts to die, and there's a hormone level that starts to decline as well. What's that signaling, the name of the signaling hormone from the placenta to the corpus luteum right here? That's called human chorionic gonadotropin. All right, and as the placenta is starting to die because it's a ectopic pregnancy, human chorionic gonadotropin levels start to decrease. All right, so some people are really concerned about ectopic pregnancies, but it's very easy to tell if somebody has an ectopic pregnancy because you can monitor the human chorionic gonadotropin levels daily, and if they start to decline, what is that a sign of? Ectopic pregnancy, right, or distress of the placenta, and then you have to take very seriously finding that ectopic pregnancy where it's located, right? So if somebody has an ectopic pregnancy, it's really easy to diagnose and follow. And who's at a high risk of ectopic pregnancy? Someone with any kind of history of pelvic inflammatory disease, all right? But it's really easy to track and to treat if that happens, all right? So with good prenatal care, you don't have to worry about losing your life if you become pregnant, right? Just by following that human chorionic gonadotropin. And then if it starts to decline, then some really easy ultrasound imaging studies can find where that ectopic pregnancy is. All right, so if you have any concern, be sure you talk with your OBGYN and they'll figure out what to do. It's easy to figure that process out. Okay, so that's it for lecture for today. I just need to talk about oogenesis a little bit next time. All right, we talked about spermatogenesis. So when we talk about oogenesis, don't forget about this meiosis that we talked about. Okay, the ploidy, the diploidy, haploidy, and gametes. Okay, that's it for today. There's a sign-in sheet going around somewhere. And those of you will have a practicum pretty close to noon today. Oh, one last thing. Those of you that have a practicum Wednesday morning, right, at 7:30, don't forget, it's scheduled at 8:30 because we don't need all morning to take that practicum. So on Wednesday, 8:30 is the practicum, not 7:30.